This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello. For 500 years, Cuthbert was the preeminent English saint, and his tombs were major sites of pilgrimage. Now at Durham, he was buried first on Lindisfarne in 687 AD, where monks shared vivid stories of his sanctifying miracles, his healing, and his power over nature. In his lifetime, he was both hermit and kingmaker, bishop and travelling priest, and the many accounts we have of him, including two by the Venerable Bede, tell us much of the values of those who venerated him so soon after his death. With me to discuss St. Cuthbert are Jane Hawkes, Professor of Medieval Art History at the University of York, Sarah Foote, the Regius Professor of Ecclesiastical History at the University of Oxford and Canon of Christ Church Cathedral, and John Hines, Professor of Archaeology at Cardiff University. John Hines, what do we know about Cuthbert's early life?
Well, there isn't a great deal of detail recorded about Cuthbert's background, but we do at least know that his childhood was spent in an area of what's now the Scottish borders, close to the Lammermuir Hills. There's also evidence from which we can tell that he must have belonged to the richer and more privileged classes of that society. And perhaps the most telling story is when in his late teens he arrives at the monastery of Melrose in Roxburghshire, as it was, to join the monastic community there. He turned up on horseback and carrying a spear, both of which were in effect status symbols. They were
symbols. With an attendant, I understand.
Yeah, well, indeed, yes. You know, it showed he was a free man of considerable status within that area. Now, in that light, it's particularly intriguing that we don't have any information whatsoever on his parentage and what immediate family he belonged to. We do know that he was fostered, apparently at the age of seven, but the information that we've got about that is simply a later record of who his foster mother, a woman called Cairnswyth, was, and we're told about her then that she had become a religious woman who was living the life of a nun. It's perhaps important to stress that the fact that a boy of about seven was fostered in another household doesn't by any means imply that he was orphaned. This was quite a regular practice. One of the stories that we've got of Cuthbert's early years talks of him keeping sheep out on the hills along with some other shepherds. This has obviously got biblical connotations, but it's not something that means that Cuthbert was of a particularly modest or ordinary status any more than David, the youngest son of Jesse in the Old Testament, was. What it does do is place him very firmly and practically in the farming, pastoral, transhumance economy of this particular part of Northumbria. Other than Bede, there was a much earlier life of considerably earlier life of Cuthbert, the so-called anonymous life, and that refers to him very briefly as having spent some time on a military campaign, which is exactly what you'd expect of a young man of this rank. There's other stories talk about him having an infirmity causing lameness, and one does just wonder whether there were some recurrent physical problems that he had.
That's rather backed up by the idea, the notion, I don't know how, what validity you give to this, that he liked doing gymnastics, he was good at doing somersaults and backflips and all the rest of it, and that might have, he might have hurt his knee doing that and lamed him to a certain extent. And it's also remarked in that context that he didn't show much religious inclination as a young. We're not talking about the young genius of sanctity from an early age.
No. He isn't one of those horrible pious children at the age of three who are singing.
Are all pious children horrible?
Sorry, well, not necessarily, but some of them are in these stories, of course. We do actually. There is anatomical study of Cuthbert's skeleton. The stories of him being well built, athletic, and strong do seem credible if the skeletal remains that were studied in 1899 in Durham are actually his own.
Sarah Foote, a lot of his life was spent in Northumbria. Now, Christianity had just reached Northumbria then. Can you tell us a bit about the arrival of Christianity in Northumbria?
Christianity had first reached Northumbria in Roman times, but the Roman church is much diminished after the end of Roman rule in Britain, and insofar as the Romano-British Church still survived in the north. It's probably in the western parts of the region Cumbria and the like. But Christianity is introduced to the Anglian pagan settlers north of the Humber twice over in the early part of the 7th century. There's first a Roman mission that comes from Canterbury, led by a bishop called Paulinus, who comes with accompanying the king Edwin's Christian wife to the court of Edwin and successfully converts large numbers of people, mass baptisms at York in the year 627. But after Edwin's death, the kingdom reverted to paganism. And it was only on the accession of Oswald, who had spent time in exile on the Scottish island of Iona, where he had been converted to Christianity by Irish monks, that a new effort is made to bring Christianity into Northumbria, with Irish monks coming from Iona at Oswald's invitation, being given a seat for their bishopric on the coastal tidal island of Northumbria, and led by an Irish bishop whose name was Aidan.
Can you give us some more information about Iona at that time, the seeding and breeding ground of what became, I suspect wrongly called, Celtic Christianity?
Can we talk about Irish Christianity in this context? These are Irish monks who've come to settle off the western coast of Scotland, led by a very charismatic, ascetic and energetic figure called Columba, who had a great passion for living the monastic life, but also an enormous passion for mission and evangelisation among the Scottish peoples. So travelled long distances away from the island to get out among the remote rural population. There are lots of amazing stories about his encounters with the natural world, including a supposed incident on the banks of Loch Ness, where he encountered a mysterious monster in the waters, and also lots of occasions when angels spoke to him and ministered to his needs. And some of those same themes come out in the lives of Cuthbert.
How different was the Ionian Irish Church, from the Roman, perhaps we could call it English-based at Canterbury?
I think the differences are first and foremost organisational. The Roman Church has a different view of bishops from that of the Irish Church. Bishoprics in Ireland are very small, and bishops don't have major administrative, judicial, governmental responsibilities in the Irish Church. So they tended to seek people out for the episcopacy because of their spiritual gifts, not because of their administrative talents. But the other thing that really marks out the difference between monks in the Roman and the Irish traditions is that Roman monks are much more closely tied to the monastic institutions to which they belong. They tend to follow rules that stress stability and staying within the community, whereas Irish monks like Columba, Aidan, Cuthbert tend to travel long distances away from their home base. Cuthbert could sometimes be away for as much as a month at a time, and this wasn't thought to be inappropriate behaviour. It was in order to enable him to get to the most rugged parts of the region so he could reach those people who hadn't yet had the opportunity to have Christian teaching. And of course, the other really big difference between the Irish and the Roman churches, and the one that Bede makes a great deal of in his history, is that they use different systems for calculating the date of Easter, which could cause some tensions when their different calendars came up with different answers in the same year.
Can you tell us how the Irish church, how it felt about this presence of the Roman church?
It's possible to overstate the possible tensions and difficulties between Roman and Irish Christianity. It's important to bear in mind that both churches believed in one God and the persons of the Trinity. They believed in the promises of salvation made by Christ. They believed in the importance of his resurrection and his ascension. And they believed that it mattered enormously that as many people as possible should be brought to hear that good news and brought into the sheepfold of all believers before the last judgment, when an Irish monk or bishop, just as much as a Roman one, would have felt the anxiety about what they were going to say to Christ at the last judgment if there were all these people in remote settlements who'd never heard the good news of the gospel and so were going to be damned. And I think the fact that both churches feel passionately about mission and the need to spread the gospel is more important than the differences between them. Yes, they cut their hair in different ways, so the Roman tonsure is supposed to imitate that of St. Peter and modelled on the crown of thorns, so you just shave the middle of the top part of the head. The Irish tonsure was different. It meant that you could probably distinguish Irish and Roman monks when you saw them. But ultimately, they're teaching one faith, one church, one resurrection, eternal life for all believers.
Thank you. Jane, in the stories of Cuthbert, we hear a lot about his travelling around, which is different from the Romans being more used to sticking inside their monastery. Why was that important to Cuthbert to travel around so much? He even came across to Carlisle.
Yes, he did. He gets taken on a tour around the Roman ruins, Cuthbert as tourist. But he also has a vision in which he sees the forthcoming death of the king. So he does forewarn the king that if he continues his campaigns ultimately against the Irish, he'll come to a sticky end, which is exactly what happens.
And there's still a St. Cuthbert's Church in Carlisle, just next to the cathedral. At one point he was sent to a religious establishment, so occasionally
he was
sent to this place in Coldingham
to
address problems there. What does that tell us?
Well, it's actually one of my favourite stories about Cuthbert. It was an Irish foundation, and those were in the early days marked very often by housing both monks and nuns. And it seems that the abbess, Ethelthryth, I was having a bit of a problem with the monks and the nuns getting a little bit too friendly. So Cuthbert went along to try and sort it out. And when he was done for the day, he went and had what Sister Benedicta Ward called the equivalent of a cold shower, seen by one of the monks at Coldingham, hiding behind a hedge, watching Cuthbert standing pretty well up to his neck in the cold waters at the mouth of the River Tweed. And when he's calmed down sufficiently or cooled off sufficiently, he comes out and a family of sea otters come up and lick him dry. All of that said, it gives us a real insight into how Cuthbert really was operating at the highest level as some sort of a diplomat within church circles, ecclesiastical circles.
Thank you. John Hines, can we develop the Cuthbert's dealings with royalty, and what does that tell us?
Without doubt, there was a very close relationship indeed between kingship and the church, not just in Northumbria, but in fact throughout Anglo-Saxon England and indeed throughout all of the different communities and populations of early medieval Britain.
Would it be fair to say this was stronger on the part of the women in the royal court than the men, that the women welcomed these preachers?
Certainly, I wouldn't actually quite say it was stronger on the part of the women, but there were different and complementary gendered roles there. So at Whitby, we've got the famous Abbot Hild and her successor, a woman called Alflid, this woman Abba up at Coldingham as well. And it does in fact seem as if Cuthbert tends to communicate with the king himself through those abbesses.
The women were also powerful in that part of the world. The women inherited. So he was not dealing with, as it were, the inferior power person. He was dealing often with a very powerful power person at the court.
Oh, I completely agree. And saying that these were complementary roles, all of which were representing the interests of the same family and kin group, doesn't in any way suggest that women, these women who were playing those roles, were merely puppets in the hand of the powerful men. Clearly, there were women. I mean, this was a male-centred society. There's no question of that. But in so many of these male-centred societies, there are ways in which resourceful, able, and indeed privileged women can exercise an extraordinary amount of power and influence.
Whether Cuthbert and King Edgefrith had ever actually met, there is one occasion when they did, which is when Cuthbert was being asked if he would become bishop. There had been a synod held with Archbishop Theodore and King Edgefrith, and Cuthbert was chosen as the bishop, but he was then a hermit on his island of Farne and he didn't want to become bishop. And the story goes that Edgefrith went to the island to confront Cuthbert and say he had to do this. And in the wonderful 12th century manuscript of the Lives of Bede's Lives of Cuthbert, there's a full page illustration of the king confronting the saint in his cell, begging him to come out and do this thing for the world instead of staying in his hermitage and praying by himself. So there is that one occasion when I think they did meet.
He seemed to oscillate between being a hermit on this little island, the Farne Island, where he built himself a shelter of sorts, and dealing with royalty and travelling around. Now, can you talk to me a bit about him being a hermit and why he decided to go to Farne Island?
The desire that he would spend some of his time in solitude is something, is an undercurrent that seems to run all the way through his whole life. The anonymous life of Cuthbert divides his life into different life stages and makes them hermetically sealed and separate from one another. But Bede's life smooths those edges out and suggests that Cuthbert always, once he'd become a monk, always sought to get away from the others. So even when he was living in the community at Lindisfarne, he used to sometimes spend the whole night awake, walking up and down or working with his hands as he said his psalms as a way of warding off the enemy sleep. But he also had a little sort of hermitage just off the edge of the island of Lindisfarne, a tiny little island known as St Cuthbert's Isle. And he used to retire there as much as he could. After he'd been for a while, the chronology is very vague, but a while at Lindisfarne, he asked and got permission. It's very important he didn't go and do this without the permission of the abbot and the other monks, to go and live in complete solitude on Farne, which is just a small way away from Lindisfarne. And there he built himself a cell very much in the Irish model, a circular sort of dwelling cut out of the rock with walls high enough to prevent him from being able to see out and look at the sea or admire the landscape or see who was coming to visit him. He made the walls so high that he could only see the sky above his head.
Is there any way at all that we have any knowledge of what he was contemplating and how he was contemplating? Did he have rules of meditation? Did he What did he do? I mean, did he just think?
I think that he is spending a great amount of his time reciting the Psalms of the Psalter and praying through them as he says them from memory. There is a suggestion that he is combating demons. So whether these are figments of his own imagination or whether these are demonic figures that come and torment him to try and persuade him to give up his austerity and lead a slightly more relaxed way of life. This is a well-established means of getting oneself closer to God. You cut yourself off from all the pleasures of the flesh, and particularly from the company and distraction of other human beings, so that by focusing on the Word of God, and the Word of God especially as articulated through the Psalms of the Psalter, that helps you to climb the ladder, which will in the end bring you closer to heaven. But all the accounts suggest that psalmody lies absolutely at the heart of Cuthbert's independent prayer life.
Thank you.
I mean, in addition to that, we do know that he was trying to grow crops out there. So it wasn't, you know, totally a life of prayers.
He's praying through the work. He's praying through the work of his hands.
Absolutely. So can we just sort of stress another point there, too, which is that Inner Farn is some miles off from Holy Island. You know, they are indivisible, but it's only about a mile offshore from Bamborough, which is the great royal centre. So it's not remote and inconspicuous by any means indeed. And for this legend of Edgefrith going out, it is a romantic legend of Edgefrith going out there to beg him to accept the bishopric is a story that represents very, very nicely the relationship between his rather ostentatious ascetic spirituality of being on his own, and the fact that it's being performed in direct view of the royal centre.
Can we stick to the idea of the island journey? As I understand it, in imitation of the Antonines of, say, the 4th century, who went into the desert to cut themselves off from earthly temptations, so they were just surrounded by desert in the Middle East, and there being few deserts in the north. Anyway, they chose islands, so they were surrounded by water, which helped to cut them off. Did that play a part?
Yes, I think it will have done, but as John has just intimated, sea is also a major highway. Holy Island is a tidal island, so it's actually connected to the mainland.
Holy Island being Lindisfarne, yes.
Yeah, being where Lindisfarne is situated. But these places are all very close together, and they are absolutely interconnected if you accept that water is your main way of getting from A to B. So getting from Holy Island or Lindisfarne down to Whitby, just going down the coast, would take you next to no time at all, whereas doing it by land, where road conditions were not that great, you would have preferred to go by sea and just navigated with the land in sight.
John Hines, let's go back to Lindisfarne now. He came to be treated as a saint by the monks of Lindisfarne. He became the bishop of Lindisfarne. So can we tie all these together, the saints, the Lindisfarne, the island, and the becoming of a bishop? How did Lindisfarne associate himself with him, or he with Lindisfarne, so closely?
Well, he was sent to Lindisfarne, and from what we can tell, he was sent specifically to enforce a more Roman style of discipline on this originally Irish monastery that there was out there. And really, he did it by very largely imitating the life and virtues of the great missionary saint, Bishop Aidan. And in some ways, his ultimately becoming bishop was the fulfilment of his reproduction of Aidan's life. The big difference between Cuthbert and Aidan is that Cuthbert was a Northumbrian, whereas Aidan, so far as we know, was solely Irish-speaking and needed an interpreter all the time. Cuthbert could talk to the people, both the monks on Holy Island and indeed those he was preaching to and baptising in that northern part of Northumbria within their own language. it wasn't by any means automatic that as a bishop he would therefore come to be venerated as a saint. It was the many great achievements that he had as a man of, I think, great piety, great commitment to his church, almost an obsessive commitment, we might say, in some ways. There was no formal process of canonization, such as we know in the modern Roman Catholic Church. This stage in the history of the church, it was largely a local matter if a cult would develop around a dead hero or heroine of the church, and in particular around the relics, the mortal remains of that particular individual, with a series of healing miracles usually being associated with those. That was how somebody came to be venerated as a saint, and that was indeed what happened with Cuthbert. There is a key story, of course, of his body being found incorrupt, but perhaps we can
this is later. That's later. We don't want to get to that yet. While he was, what were these miracles? I mean, did people, can you give us one or two more examples? Anyway, look to Sarah for a moment. Were these miracles, which played such an important part in the veneration in which he was held, were they massive, were totally believed at the time? Were they puffed up, as it were, if you'll excuse me for the word, later?
One of the striking things about the stories about Cuthbert is how many miracle stories are told of him during his own lifetime, not exclusively, but often involving occasions when he's a long way away from Melrose or Lindisfarne, among the wider population. So there's an occasion, John mentioned earlier, the fact that he had a foster mother, or Bede calls her his nurse. There's one occasion when he's visiting her, whom he used to do often, and her house caught fire, and he put the fire out and saved her from coming to harm.
Did he put the fire out, not by throwing buckets of water on it, but by prayer?
But through prayer. It was through his prayer and invocation to heaven that caused the flames to go out, which, of course, instantly was believed by all those people round about who had seen the fire blazing and his nurse in real danger. Even before he became a monk at all, when he was a young man, there's a story when he was standing on the mouth of the River Tyne, and a collection of monks from Tynemouth Abbey were out on rafts in the river mouth, and a wind got up and they started to be dragged out to sea, and the population watching on the bank started to laugh at them, and Cuthbert prayed that the wind would change and they would be brought safely back to shore. And that's even before he'd become a monk. He's already demonstrating his capacity to control the natural world and to intercede directly with God on behalf of living people. So when, after his death, miracles start to be associated with his relics or with the place where the water which had washed his body had been poured away, then people were inclined to think, yes, we know this was a miracle worker. Indeed, a bit of that soil from the place where the water that washed his body was thrown away, put that in water and drink it, and you will indeed be relieved of your demonic possession or whatever your infirmity is.
Can we, had enough of miracles, or it is fascinating, isn't it? The evidence for them, which is would be tested and challenged by a lot of people today, perhaps.
It's interesting to note that Bede is careful on several occasions to say that he's speaking to eyewitnesses. He has testimony from people who knew Cuthbert and indeed claim to have witnessed the miracles. So that can be done, obviously, because there is scepticism, you know, without doubt. But there is care to try and make the point, to try and prove it.
Bede always did that sort of research, didn't he, whichever direction he went in.
But if I could come in at the anonymous life, which is written within about 5 years of the body being exhumed and found to be incorrupt, that it's so very soon after 698, the anonymous was able to talk to a number of people who had known Cuthbert well in life and people who had witnessed many of these miracles. And so some of the ones from the anonymous life that Bede carefully reshapes and recasts, I think it's the Lindisfarne monk and those who had lived with Cuthbert for a long time who are testifying to the fact that this was a truly remarkable man and one that they recognise to be different from themselves, even in life, and then, of course, massively in death.
So let's turn to the death, which the death is a story in itself, because the dead body continues till today to be an object of fascination. Jane Hawkes, the first burial given at Lindisfarne, can you tell us about that? And what was there, if there was, anything special about it?
Cuthbert died in a farm, and perhaps aware of his reputation, had asked his fellow monks to bury him in a farm. They, however, took ship to Innerfarne with a stone sarcophagus that had been donated and presumably wrapped him up in the very nice white fine linen shroud that had been woven by an abbess for him. His body in the sarcophagus is taken back to Holy Island and put by the side of the altar in the church at Lindisfarne. And 11 years later, the body is translated. It's taken out of the sarcophagus. Miraculously, his body was discovered to be incorrupt. The story goes that they quickly whipped together a wooden coffin, and Ecgfrith, the new abbot, the man credited with creating, penning and illustrating the Lindisfarne Gospels, takes over and oversees this translation of the body into the wooden coffin.
John Hines, what Cuthbert had some political standing during his life. What political role would you say was played by the figure of the dead Saint Cuthbert?
I could talk for a very, very long time about this.
Well, please don't, but if you can sum it up.
Yes, I will try and get just to the absolutely key points. He certainly becomes, he's now considered the patron saint of Northumberland, and there's a real sense in which he is a figure who represents the kingdom of Northumbria. Extremely striking that when the Holy Island and the monastery of Lindisfarne are raided by Viking raiders in June 793. The Northumbrian scholar and churchman on the continent, Alcuin, writing to the nobles of Northumbria, refers to the site just as the Church of Cuthbert. It must have been a deliberately targeted attack on such a central and holy site within Northumbria as this effective declaration of war between Scandinavia and Western Europe at that time. Although the comparison would have to be, I really don't think it's unrealistic at all to say that the impact that had on Northumbria itself, it's a sort of 9/11 event. That's the level of shock and outrage that was intended to be caused by the attack and which resulted from it. However, at that point, we can also say that actually Alcuin is a bit Janus-faced, really. He's got one story when he's speaking to Northumbria. He's got a different story when he's speaking to southern England, when he's writing to the Church at Canterbury. He talks about Viking raids there without making the attack on Lindisfarne the single atrocity that stands out amongst everything else.
Putting Alcuin aside for the moment, although he was a great teacher and he illuminated instigated most of the culture and certainly the Christian culture of Charlemagne and so on, let's go back to Lindisfarne, Sarah Foote. How did Cuthbert end up from Lindisfarne to Durham? How long did it take him to get there?
It took a considerable time. So John's just talked about the Viking raid in 793. Yes, it was indeed a very shocking event, but the community stayed in Lindisfarne then. It wasn't until about 875 when the pressure from Scandinavian coastal raiding and probably also the beginning of Scandinavian settlement in Northumbria made the community think that they needed to move from their isolated and vulnerable coastal site. And so they packed up the treasures of the community, the Lindisfarne Gospels, the coffin of Cuthbert with the various things of Cuthbert's that they had preserved, and the head of King Oswald of Northumbria, the king who'd first invited Irish monks from Iona to come.
But in the coffin of Cuthbert, presumably, was the dead Cuthbert.
The dead Cuthbert and the head of Oswald. And they travelled round Northumbria. They went to a variety of different places. They went to Norham on Tweed. They stayed briefly in Ripon. They went over to the west coast. They thought about whether to go to Ireland. They changed their mind. They settled in the middle years of the 10th century at Chesterley Street, because the coffin was there in 934 when Athelstan was on his way to Scotland. And he stopped off to visit the shrine of Cuthbert and made a present of Bede's two lives of the saint to the community of monks.
To cut to the chase, he leaves Lindisfarne, and a considerable time later, he ends up in Durham. What was that, 100 and how many hundred, 100 and what years?
The story is told by Simeon of Durham, writing in the early 12th century, that it was in the year 995 that the bishop of the community, Aeltun, had a warning that they ought to leave Chesterley Street and flee. They went to Durham, they went to Ripon for a bit, and then they were going to go back to where they'd been. And they were just travelling near Durham at a place called Wardalaw, and suddenly the cart carrying the coffin wouldn't go any further at all. So they stopped, they had a period of prayer and fasting and asked God what they should do, and God revealed that they should take the coffin to Durham, this uninhabited but very easily defended peninsula site, which they cleared of trees and then established first a wooden and then a stone church there.
So how long had it taken them?
875 to 995 is the conventional view. There is a young scholar at St Andrews, Neil McGuigan, who's recently argued that actually this is a complete fiction and that the chronology is wrong. And he suggests that they were in Norham on Tweed right up until the second decade of the 11th century. And he thinks that they didn't move to Durham until about till around 1020 in the reign of the Danish king Canute.
It became extraordinary, Jane Hawkes. When he arrived in Durham, and then we have the cathedral and so on, how important was it for Christianity that he was in such a place with such a magnificent edifice being built around him and himself being laid out in such splendour?
As Sarah's just intimated, with the visit of the King of Wessex to his shrine in Chesterley Street, that when he gets to Durham, the cult of St Cuthbert and the shrine of St Cuthbert is probably the most important shrine cult place of pilgrimage that was really only replaced by that of Thomas à Becket. I do think that he did spend time in Chesterley Street, which ironically was in the centre of the sort of Scandinavian heartland. And the Cuthbert community was quite important in establishing kings in York, Viking kings in York during this time. So they were working with the Vikings. And I think there was a negotiation with the Vikings that allowed them to settle in Durham eventually. So with Cuthbert with them, they retain that sense of power and authority, and the body of Cuthbert is what gives that to them, I think.
So he goes to Durham, he went to Durham, and it became the great shrine in England for many, many years, in fact, until Thomas à Becket was murdered in Canterbury Cathedral in 1170. Did that make a difference to the place, as it were, of Cuthbert in Christian worship? John?
Yes, it did. But it did because it changed the practices and the contours of the church generally. The killing of Thomas à Becket was a seismic event politically, culturally, in all sorts of ways. And one of those impacts was on the emerging business, as it indisputably was, of pilgrimage tourism. The suggestion's been around for quite some time now that Durham simply realised it had to develop its offer as a pilgrimage centre in response to the martyrdom of Thomas and the impact that had on pilgrimage to Canterbury. But I think it's really rather more that that event and the consequences it had for Canterbury simply raised the bar for what a major pilgrimage centre was supposed to be like and was supposed to provide. We can see immediately responses in the 1170s. There's a monk of Durham called Reginald who produces what ironically he calls a little book, the Libellus of the Miracles of Cuthbert. It's an enormous tome, but it does have a real focus not on the miracles that we've talked about, Jane and Sarah, before, at various places that Cuthbert was associated in around Northumbria, but much more what happens within Durham and how people go there to be healed. There's an interesting new emphasis on healing women, recognising that there are influential, affluent and pious women who've got a real interest in supporting this sort of cult. Then, a decade after that, this magnificent new illustrated manuscript of the life of Cuthbert, which is now in the British Library, that Sarah referred to earlier on, that was produced at that time. So I think what I would say is that the killing of Becket and the response to that really catalyses and accelerates a process that's already in train. Quite interestingly, there's a short Old English poem, very late literary Old English, written around about 1100, on Durham, and that actually states quite directly that in the church there, along with the saint, that is Cuthbert, there are innumerable relics and many, many miracles take place there. So what we emphasise had already been around, but suddenly it's got to be developed and promoted in a very new and much more emphatic way.
Sarah Ford, how is Cuthbert, St Cuthbert, valued today, and what for? By Christians?
I think by Christians, Cuthbert is still seen very much as a spiritual role model. The life that he lived, focusing on devotion to God as expressed through the recitation of the Psalms, is still attractive to many people. And so he's a person to be emulated and followed. I think one of the reasons why he, above all saints from the pre-Conquest period, still stands out in the popular imagination is because we have all these surviving stories about him, the three saints' lives written very soon after his death and the exhumation and reburial of his body, as well as the later miracles that John's been talking about, and all of them together, plus the very vivid images in the Yeats-Thompson manuscript in the British Library, they give you an impression of a man that you think you might be able to know. He comes across as a real human being, situated very closely in the geography and topography of northern Northumbria and the Scottish borders. And so the importance of Cuthbert as a saint for that region and the way in which he can build community identity and regional identity, I think, is something that still continues. There's a St Cuthbert's pilgrim path, which you can take walking you from Melrose to Lindisfarne, which is becoming increasingly popular. And of course, Durham remains, when we're not locked down, a major site of pilgrimage. And pilgrims go to his shrine at the east end of the cathedral, but also to visit the cathedral treasury and to look at the coffin preserved there and also the various artefacts that were found later in his tomb. So I think he's a saint that could speak to a 7th and 8th century world, but still speaks to a 21st century one.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Sarah Foote, Jane Hawkes and John Hines. Next week, it's Émilie de Châtelet, the 18th century mathematician and natural scientist who astounded the French intellectual world and outshone her friend and lover, Voltaire. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
Well, thank you. That was wonderful. Now, do you mind if we just go on to develop the podcast? If you want to take a deep breath and a drink of water, whatever it is, then we move on.
Yeah. No, I'd like to actually pick up on what Sarah ended up with.
Please do.
Because I think it's not just that we know, well, we think we know so much about Cuthbert and his life and how he managed very successfully to work both as an active Christian and as a contemplative, how he moved with royalty, but also with normal, everyday people. But he is one of the few saints for whom we actually have relics that were his possessions, his own personal possessions. And these include the cross that he wore around his neck.
Jane, could we talk about the cross?
Absolutely.
I'm really interested in... So you can describe it much more accurately than I can, but it's the only... There are a few other 7th century gold and garnet crosses that we know of, all of which are associated with women. Why is Cuthbert the only man who seemed to have owned one of these?
Well, we don't know that he was the only man who did. It's just that his has been preserved because he was wearing it round his neck. And it kind of, it was so close to his skin that as his body did start to decompose, it actually moved further into his body. So it becomes this wonderful metaphor of, you know, that early monastic ideal that you bear the cross of Christ within your breast. And this is almost physically happening with Cuthbert. And when Henry's commissioners came to kind of divest the saint of his wealthy possessions, they were kind of a bit taken aback to find the cross still there, still and his body still semi-mummified, that they just left it.
So we know that he was wearing it in death, but is it possible that it was given to him by Abbess Verca with that amazing linen or silk shroud and that he didn't, because it doesn't fit the image of the ascetic that he'd wear something that precious in life?
This is why I think it was his, because he wasn't just an ascetic. He was a kingmaker. The king had to come to him to request that he be bishop. And he is able to negotiate that post-Synod of Whitby moment and go to Lindisfarne. And where he'd previously been invited in, as you know, with the monks of Melrose to found Ripon, he then moves up to back up into North Northumberland, rather than converting to the Roman way of doing things, that's putting it very crudely, but he's able to negotiate that transition post-Synod of Whitby. And I think that being buried with that cross, which actually was broken and repaired twice during its lifetime, and I think that does fit with his travels. And I think that it's different in the past. It's difference with Southern metalwork, Anglo-Saxon metalwork of gold and garnet, is that it's not it doesn't have the gold leaf underlays for the garnet cells, which gives it a very dark red appearance. And I think that that is actually aesthetically a deliberate choice, because that colour more closely associates with the dark red of blood, whereas the golden garnet with the cloisonné work refracts light off and makes the red much brighter and much more capable of moving around and refracting light in the way that the petrol cross doesn't. And I think it fits in with the fact that he did come from the social elite when he entered the monastery. He worked with the social elite, whether ecclesiastical or secular. And he also owns a liturgical comb, which is made of elephant ivory. I mean, it's not an attractive thing to look at by any stretch of the imagination, but it is probably one of the most luxe objects that anybody could own.
Liturgical combs are not uncommon. I mean, Boniface is always handing them out to people with his letters. Yeah. But ones made of ivory, I admit, yes, very rare.
Yeah. And elephant ivory. We're not talking walrus ivory or whalebone. Yeah. We're talking, yeah. You know, the real thing here.
Sorry, can I come in on the cross, please? To Sarah in particular, and this is not to contradict anyway anything that Jane has said, but the difference between where we have got examples and know of examples, which is probably in about a dozen women's graves. Actually now, you know, more are being found, and the fact that none are known from men's graves really has to do with the massive differences that there are in burial practice for the two genders in the middle of the 7th century. Women's graves of that quality outnumber men's graves by around about 6 to 1, and the men's graves are weapon graves, you know, they are not ecclesiasts' graves that we have got. So, you know, there is nothing transgressive about that cross having been buried with a bishop, and especially as late as the 680s. The other counterexample we've got is a very, very interesting one, is that there is at least one pectoral cross in the Staffordshire Hoard where we only have male gear. And Dr. Jenny Rowlands from Dublin gave an excellent paper in Cardiff last year, really looking at some of the material there from rather more of a Welsh poetic background there, and emphasised the point that it does very much look as if we could have fragments of the regalia of a single very high status, very wealthily adorned bishop represented in that collection as well, and the pectoral cross would go with that. So, no, I don't find anything anomalous, actually, about that cross being there.
No, and I think also, I mean, just going back to your previous question, Sarah, about the shroud that was woven for him, I think it probably was linen. Because linen is, I have a student at the moment who's been doing a lot of research into the status of linen. And it really is the primo textile for signifying purity, the whiteness of it, and the fact that Christ's shroud is thought to have been linen. Linen is the material that you put over the altar. Albs that priests wear are made from white linen. So the material that is closest to the body of the priest and which covers the table of Christ at the altar is linen. And I think that's absolutely in keeping with the idea of weaving a white linen shroud for Cuthbert.
There was some criticism about him being, please take it up and rubbish it if you want, but still about him being rude and disparaging of women, and about him being peremptory and so on. He is not thought to be entirely that false, even in the hagiographies.
The idea that Cuthbert's a misogynist is really a 12th century invention. But it is true that there are a couple of stories in the Bede prose life which retell stories from the anonymous life in a way that make the Abbess of Whitby, Alflad, Edgefrith's sister, come out in not a very good light. And those do need, I think, to argue that it's misogyny, it would be to be going too far. I mean, he spends a lot of time, we talked about it, he spends a lot of time with royal religious women, but he does have quite a go at Alflad, especially when she interrupts a service that Cuthbert was performing, dedicating a church, and when she rushes in to say, oh, I know who died, this monk died, Cuthbert tells her off. And you might wonder whether actually he was holding her to a higher standard. You know, should the abbess be rushing in the middle of a service and interrupting the worship? She's supposed to be in charge and setting an example. Did Bede think that this was a good way just to remind royal abbesses, of whom he must have known plenty as well, that there are higher authorities than they?
Yeah, no, I agree with that, because I think so many of Cuthbert's post-mortem miracles involve women. And I think that sort of Cuthbert having little to do with women is a much later invention. And I have to say, from personal experience, the first time I went to Durham in the late 1970s, the black line is still there on the floor beyond which women were not meant to advance. And my son was pretty much a babe in arms at that time. And a man in a black frock did come up and tell me off for walking beyond that line and heading towards the altar down the nave. So, you know, that aspect of the cult, I would A, say is a late invention, and B, it took a long time to see its way through.
Could I just sort of follow up on that? Because, it's particularly picking up that word you used of post-mortem there, Jane, and it comes out to something that you said before, which is one of the real fascinations of Cuthbert, is that those relics are still very really there, and indeed have been exhumed and translated many times over, twice in the 19th century, which is why we've got these anatomical, very detailed, pathological, for the time at least, studies of them. And I'm just wondering if I can just sort of put it out there as an idea. What do you two think about the idea that, given where laboratory science now is for the study of human skeletal remains, given that if we've got Oswald's head in there, chopped about but with the parietal bones there, one should be able to get complete DNA sequences, genome sequences, from these two individuals. We should be able to look at the remains of Cuthbert, determine if they are probably Cuthbert's remains, as I think they very much certainly are, and then see what the impact of his lifestyle and his diet actually had on them. To me, that is a scientific study that would actually really justify the opening up of a grave, which has to be done very carefully and respectfully, of course, and only with very good reason. But it seems an infinitely better project to aim for than some of the crazier hunts for relics of kings here.
Did Richard Bailey not track down some of Cuthbert's teeth?
He tracked down people who, yeah, clearly when his grave was opened up in the 1820s, various souvenirs were pinched, including a few of his teeth. So he knew where they had got to.
Yeah, I just wondered
whether he's actually found the teeth or not, I don't know.
If they could be resurrected and subject to DNA analysis.
Yeah, well, it's the parietal bone from the skull is what you want to go for. So
I think we should we've got to the tooth, so I think we can close it there. Thank you all very much indeed. Thank you.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
A new podcast series from BBC Radio 4.
In the first stage of a poltergeist haunting, the entity will confine itself to making noise, as if it's testing its victims.
The Battersea Poltergeist.
My name's Shirley Hitchens. I'm 15 years old. I live with my mum, dad, brother, gran, and Donald.
Subscribe to The Battersea Poltergeist on BBC Sounds.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.